The Tom Woods Show, episode 479.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Everybody, if you've been meaning to start that blog or website, but you don't know what your first steps are, then check out the free ebook I created for you, taking you step by step through the process, including a free video tutorial showing you how to get a blog up and running in just 5 minutes. Plus, if you check out tomwoods.com/publicity before starting up that blog, I'll give you some free publicity right out of the gate. So check it all out, the free ebook, the video tutorial, and the publicity offer at tomwoods.com/publicity. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Talking about John C. Calhoun a little bit today, but not just about him. I want to talk about a book that I read not too long ago. I finally have time to write articles again. You remember I pretty much stopped doing everything other than the show while I was working on the Ron Paul curriculum courses. But now that that's behind me, I actually have time to do things once again. So when Dan McCarthy of the American Conservative magazine asked if I would review a book that looked sort of interesting to me, and it wasn't a terribly long book, I said, what the heck, I'll dive right back into writing articles. So I have an article in the current issue of the American Conservative magazine, September-October 2015. It's also available on the website, and naturally, what else? Of course, I'm going to link to it on today's show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/479. The book is called Conservative Heroes, 14 Leaders Who Shaped America, From Jefferson to Reagan, by somebody named Garland S. Tucker III. I know nothing about him. And now, of course, the subtitle leads to a lot of other questions, including Jefferson among conservatives is a controversial placement. Those of you who have taken the History of Conservatism and Libertarianism course over at libertyclassroom.com will know that that's actually one of the issues that Professor Jewell starts off with, to show how tricky it is to nail down American conservatism. I may spend a whole show on Jefferson, actually, just trying to figure out who he really was and does he fall into one of these camps or not. So I think I'll save that. And then Ronald Reagan, of course, there's not going to be any book of conservative heroes that won't mention Ronald Reagan. So he's a fairly conventional choice, as is Barry Goldwater, as is William F. Buckley Jr. But the reason the book is interesting is that so many of the other people are the exact opposite of people you would expect to see. Well, not the exact opposite, but let's just say not the sort of people you would expect to see in the standard collection of conservative heroes. Why is that? I've seen many books in this genre, my friends, and they consist of Abraham Lincoln, Daniel Webster, Alexander Hamilton, and the sort of people that all right-thinking individuals are expected to admire. And these are held up for us as model conservatives. Well, you know what? Been there, done that, right? We don't need another book in that tradition. It's entirely predictable. I know every word that's going to be in one of those books that takes for granted that the principles we ought to admire are centralization and so on and so forth. We know all this stuff. What is interesting to me, and the reason that Dan assigned me this book, is that this book is published by the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which is a standard conservative organization, although one that does reach out to me from time to time. So it's a few notches above, I should say, the standard conservative organization. But also that it features people who really are more in the libertarian camp or the paleo camp in a good way. So I thought, even though this isn't the most exciting book in the history of the world, so I don't encourage you to rush out and get a copy, I thought it was worth noting that a book with such a source and with a foreword by Amity Schlaes, who has been a guest on this show, by the way, but who probably isn't fully in our camp, I'll put it that way, the fact that a book like that features the sort of individuals I'm going to talk about today is noteworthy, and that's really why I wrote the review. So I want to go through this. I think you'll find some of these people interesting, and then at the end, I'll spend some time talking about Calhoun in particular, because I do get people asking me, what should we think about Calhoun? I mean, obviously, he has some very serious demerits, but should we reject him altogether? Can we glean some insights from him? So I'll say a little bit about that at the end. Also at the end, by the way, I'll give you some details about some upcoming speaking events I have coming up very, very soon. It's, as I'm publishing this episode today, it's August 31st, 2015. Got an event coming up in Houston on September 11th and 12th. So that's really, really soon. So Houston, then Granby, Colorado, then the Dallas area, and then New York City. So I'll have the details on that after I'm done dealing with all this. And, of course, you can just check out tomwoods.com/events. Well, we have here in this book people like John Randolph of Roanoke, who was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee under Thomas Jefferson and who really out-Jeffersoned Jefferson. Randolph of Roanoke was a fascinating guy to read and learn about. I think my favorite book by Russell Kirk is his biography of John Randolph, which he wrote as a young man. Grover Cleveland makes an appearance in this book. He's one of three U.S. presidents to be in the book, Ronald Reagan and Calvin Coolidge, the other two. Cleveland was anti-inflationist. He was generally laissez-faire. He was a constitutionalist, and although he was by no means a strict non-interventionist overseas, certainly he was an opponent of the drive toward imperialism that was gathering steam in the late 19th century. Now, unfortunately, although Tucker is the author of the book, Garland Tucker, he talks about Cleveland, but he doesn't include this foreign policy stuff that I just mentioned. But that, too, is important. I mean, it's great that Cleveland is mentioned, because Cleveland is forgotten by almost everybody. But Cleveland, if you had to choose a handful of presidents, well, Cleveland was what so many Republicans pretend to be. Cleveland really was. And Cleveland, of course, himself was a Democrat. But his overall approach to foreign policy is interesting and belongs in a book like this because it shows that he was a conservative, given that war is the most unconservative thing a society can undertake. It uproots everything. It introduces instability everywhere. It has highly unpredictable outcomes. It involves, well, all kinds of moral outrages, and you would think that a school of thought that's always hectoring us about moral relativism would be particularly attuned to that. So, for instance, he was not at all sympathetic to people who wanted a war over Cuba. There were people who were agitating for a war over Cuba throughout the 1890s. They didn't get it until 1898 under William McKinley. But in fact, Cleveland went to the extreme of saying that if Congress should declare war over Cuba, he would just refuse to call up the army. He did not make any moves to annex Hawaii. And in failing to do so, he frustrated imperialist ambitions yet again. Hawaii was very much desired by imperialists for a variety of reasons. A lot of these people believe that the China market, Asian markets, were the wave of the future for the American economy. There was this view that Americans have already purchased all the goods they can possibly purchase, so we now need to dump excess goods on the China market. So there's this idea that there's a possibility of a general glut, which we've talked about in at least one episode. I think we may have talked about it with Robert Blumen. Just in case, I will include the episode with Robert Blumen and the episode with Stephen Cates in the show notes on the show notes page. Jotting this down right now so I don't forget. I have a middle-aged man's brain after all. But his view was that in Hawaii there had been a coup that had overturned the government and installed one that he believed was unrepresentative of the Hawaiian people, and he did not want to be a party to that by carrying through an annexation of Hawaii. So to me, you just have to mention something like that. You can't just leave that hanging. That's pretty important to who Cleveland was. And it might be important to what conservatism ought to be. So it's at least something that deserves discussion. And I didn't find it in the book, so I mentioned that. We do read something about Cleveland's approach to domestic affairs. Although even here, why don't we read about the way Cleveland dealt with labor union violence? That's an important ingredient. That's an important part of Cleveland's domestic policy, but we don't get any discussion of that. What we do get, certainly, are illustrative examples of Cleveland's governing style and his policy positions. And this one's a particular favorite of mine. In 1887, and that reminds me, I suppose I should give the dates for Grover Cleveland. I shouldn't assume everybody knows his dates, especially the non-American listeners, but even American listeners probably haven't memorized the presidents and their dates. But Cleveland, of course, is the one president, as we all know, who served two non-consecutive terms. He was elected in 1884 for 4 years and then elected again in 1892. Well, anyway, in 1887, several counties in Texas had suffered a terrible drought. So Congress proposed a $10,000 grant for seed grain. Cleveland vetoes this. Why does he veto it? Is it too much money? That's not relevant. The point is, it's not constitutional, no matter how much money it is. He said that, these are his words, that he could not indulge a benevolent and charitable sentiment through the appropriation of public funds. And he said that he could find, quote, no warrant for such an appropriation in the Constitution. So here's this trivial amount of money for a purpose that most people would consider benign, but he would not go along with the appropriation because he could not find anywhere in the Constitution that authorized it. Well, as it turns out, by the way, here's the government trying to raise $10,000 to spend for this purpose. But voluntary charitable donations for this purpose amounted to $150,000. So private individuals raised 15 times as much as the U.S. government was proposing to spend. So it turns out that civil society can, in fact, look after itself. How about that? Let's say something about one of the other presidents mentioned in here, and that's Calvin Coolidge. I will include on the show notes page the episode I did with Amity Schles, who is a biographer of Calvin Coolidge. That was a very interesting episode, so we'll put that on there. Again, it's tomwoods.com/479 for episode 479. Now, we've all heard, practically everybody, Calvin Coolidge's remark, and again, the dates, sorry. Coolidge became president first in 1923 when Warren Harding died while in office, and then he was elected in his own right in 1924, and then he chose not to run for re-election in 1928. Well, everybody has heard, probably, Coolidge's remark that the chief business of the American people is business. That was a speech he gave in 1925. And this is always trotted out to portray Coolidge as this Neanderthal, Philistine, not in touch with the higher things and just fixated on money-making. Well, it's interesting to note what else he said in that 1925 speech. Here's the part they don't quote. He said, "It is only those who do not understand our people who believe our national life is entirely absorbed by material motives. We make no concealment of the fact that we want wealth, but there are many other things we want much more. We want peace and honor, and that charity which is so strong an element of all civilization. The chief ideal of the American people is idealism." Well, how about that? There's a passage I would be willing to guess at least 90% of you have never heard. It's not your fault. Who's going to point it out to you? Now, Coolidge, of course, is a familiar enough name to most people, but I tend to believe that even most libertarians and conservatives, especially younger ones, will never have heard of Josiah Bailey. No one talks about Josiah Bailey anymore. But he played a key role in drafting the Conservative Manifesto of 1937. And that is worth noting. That's a part of American history. Bailey belonged to the dwindling but pugnacious Jeffersonian wing of the Democratic Party. And he was seeking to foster a coalition of Republicans and conservative Democrats to try to stop Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Now, this is, to my mind, a fairly interesting historical moment, but not exactly front and center in the typical classroom discussion. Now, Bailey had been involved in another bipartisan effort before the Conservative Manifesto, and that was the campaign against FDR's court-packing scheme. And that scheme amounted to adding an additional Supreme Court justice for every existing justice over age 70. And this was, he said in all seriousness, to help them with their caseload, even though they protested there was no problem handling the caseload. Obviously, that was an attempt to fill the court with people more in line with New Deal thinking, so that the president wouldn't see so many New Deal initiatives called unconstitutional. Well, even a lot of Democrats abandoned FDR on this because it seemed to be such a transparently partisan move on his part to pack the court with more sympathetic justices. So it's interesting to note that Joseph Robinson, who was the Senate Majority Leader at the time, reflecting on Bailey's denunciation of the plan on the Senate floor, said, That rare thing, a successful and convincing argument, was being made on the Senate floor, and eventually FDR had to abandon the plan. But back to the Conservative Manifesto, this was a statement of principles in opposition to the New Deal, although it did not mention FDR by name. It was a systematic critique of the economic program of the vast bulk of Bailey's own party. But just as Bailey was behind the scenes assembling his coalition of conservative Democrats and Republicans, the document was leaked to the press by the Republican Senate Minority Leader. His view was that the manifesto would hurt his party's election prospects, so he blew the whistle on it, and the resulting confusion before Bailey could get commitments from all the people he wanted wound up leaving the whole plan in shambles, and it simply withered away. So how about that? The Republican leadership making sure that something that might do some good is quashed before anything can come of it. How about that, huh? Well, then also figuring in here, and I just love this, Senator Robert Taft, who, although he was not a complete non-interventionist, took very courageous stances on otherwise fairly popular foreign policy positions that were adopted by Harry Truman in the late 40s and into the 1950s. Senator Taft was known as Mr. Republican in his day. So I always love to trot that out against neocons on Facebook, you know, who don't realize that Mr. Republican basically would have opposed everything they're up to. So that is kind of funny. It was Taft, for example, who stood up in the Senate and said that it was totally unconstitutional for Harry Truman to send all, you know, these huge numbers of American troops all the way over to Korea to fight in the Korean War. He said, you can't do that. You have to consult Congress. You can't say, well, the United Nations has supported it, so therefore I don't need to go to Congress. Even the UN Participation Act of 1945 said that each member nation should decide on war according to its respective constitutional processes. That the mere fact that the UN authorizes something does not in and of itself override the traditional constitutional process in each country of deciding whether or not to go to war. Truman was claiming that it did. He didn't need to consult Congress. Plus, it's not even a war. It's a police action, if you can believe that inane argument. And it was Taft who stood up and said, you can't do that. Now, of course, now you get Republicans who, under the Bush, in the Bush years, were all for letting the president do what he wanted. Then under Obama, they've changed a little, but not all of them. You get people like Mark Levin saying, hooray for Obama. If he wants to intervene in Libya, he has every right to do that. Now, of course, he has no right whatsoever to do that. And I had a sort of notorious back and forth with Mark Levin on this very subject. I write about it in my book, Real Dissent, which you can check out at realdissent.com. I will also link on the show notes page to my exchange with Mark Levin, which I think you will find interesting. What's interesting about Taft, though, is some stuff that doesn't make it into the Garland-Tucker book. It's great that Taft is in there because the neocons hate him, and it's good to see a mainstream conservative organization talking about Taft. In the book, we do read that Taft opposed the internationalists in the Republican Party in the 1940 election, but we don't read anything about the 1952 election. That's the key thing. When he had his famous showdown with Dwight Eisenhower for the Republican nomination. The loss that Taft suffered in that nominating process was the beginning of the end of the less interventionist wing of the Republican Party. And moreover, it seems to me it would have been much more interesting if we'd included the following things in the chapter on Taft. First, his skepticism of the Truman Doctrine. This was really where, although the Truman Doctrine dealt by name only with Greece and Turkey, the principle behind the Truman Doctrine really opened up the U.S. to all kinds of interventions all over the world, that we've got to stop communism, you know, pretty much everywhere. Taft also spoke out against the Marshall Plan, which is supported by all right-thinking people. Why, without the Marshall Plan, Western Europe won't have economic recovery. Well, that's not true either. I'll talk about, let's see, what can I do with on the show notes page on the Marshall Plan? I'll link you to the great article by Tyler Cowen on this. Best thing Tyler Cowen ever wrote is his article on why the Marshall Plan does not deserve the credit for Western European economic recovery. Put that in there. TomWoods.com/479 is starting to look more attractive all the time, is it not? And then also the creation of NATO. He was against that. So, I mean, this is interesting stuff. I mean, here you have a conservative, Mr. Republican himself, making arguments against some of the best-known initiatives of the early Cold War, and these don't make the cut in the Taft chapter? That is hard to excuse. Well, anyway, let's turn now to just at least a few brief moments on the issue of John C. Calhoun. Now, first of all, who was he? He served in the House of Representatives. He served as Secretary of War. He served as the Vice President. He served in the U.S. Senate. And he served as Secretary of State. While he was Vice President, he began to have a falling out with President Andrew Jackson to the point where he resigned from the Vice Presidency, went back to South Carolina, got elected to the U.S. Senate from South Carolina, and then confronted President Jackson in the U.S. Senate over the subject of the Tariff of Abominations, which gave no relief from the tariff regime under which the South lived. And it was Calhoun's view that this was obviously a sectional measure that benefited one section of the country at the expense of the other. So he led the nullification effort against that tariff himself. And he wrote a tremendous amount, wrote an awful lot about political theory that's very much worth reading. Murray Rothbard was quite fond of Calhoun, certainly his disquisition on government. So that's very much worth looking into, the works of Calhoun. Liberty Fund published an excellent collection of the works of Calhoun called Liberty and Union. Now, my understanding is that they would never, ever publish works like that again. That anybody who had anything to do with slavery, they're never going to publish. But in the old days, before they had that view, they published more widely in a more diverse collection of people, including Calhoun. Now, of course, the issue that comes up almost all the time when you talk about Calhoun is that he was a defender of slavery. So, and obviously that is not a small demerit against him, needless to say. But we're told that that pretty much invalidates everything he had to say. But it's interesting to note that the abolitionists themselves didn't think so. And they were the ones who were really on the front lines of the battle against slavery. I mean, it's easy for us in the year 2015 to look down our noses at people and render our highfalutin moral judgments, but the people who were actually on the ground at the time had no problem citing Calhoun by name. I mentioned this in my book Nullification, and I'll maybe if I have the memory, I'll link to my book Nullification on the show notes page. Why not, right? Why not link to that? In case you haven't done so already, you can get a free audiobook through TomWoodsAudio.com, and Nullification is one of the ones that's available. You can get that for free. But in there, I point out that the abolitionists mentioned Calhoun by name when they made arguments about why the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 ought to be nullified, that the states ought to refuse to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And they cited Calhoun as one of the key architects of the idea of nullification. Of course, it goes back to Jefferson and even before that. But they had no problem saying, well, obviously he's grotesquely morally wrong on one issue, but that doesn't mean that everything he says is wrong or that he doesn't have a brain or that his reasoning is always wrong. Why don't we take what we can from somebody? So that was their view. It's also worth noting that when John Tyler, President Tyler, nominated Calhoun to be Secretary of State, Calhoun was confirmed by the Senate in just a matter of hours. And there wasn't a single dissenting vote. Even the anti-slavery senators of Vermont, not a dissenting vote. So, again, that's worth noting, I think. Now, reading here from a book called Forgotten Conservatives in American History by Clyde Wilson, who was the editor of the Calhoun Papers, so a tremendous scholar of Calhoun. Everybody respects the work he did on the papers of Calhoun. And Brian McClanahan, who's a faculty member at mylibertyclassroom.com. He's been a guest on this show before. And in their chapter in Calhoun, they say, the notion that Calhoun was all about slavery and nothing but slavery is a product of the current reign of cultural Marxism, and it does not represent a balanced view of American history. It has not always been so. In 1950, Margaret Coit's admiring biography, John C. Calhoun, American Portrait, won a Pulitzer Prize. In 1959, a committee chaired by John F. Kennedy named Calhoun as one of the five greatest senators of all time. Calhoun's a disquisition on government has been recognized in every generation and internationally as among the most important political treatises written by an American. And they continue, it is somewhat ridiculous to single out Calhoun as a defender of slavery when no one in his time proposed any serious solution to the slavery question. Indeed, Lincoln himself on his election declared he would not know what to do about slavery even if he had the power. So on the show notes page, I will also include an article or two on this subject of Calhoun and slavery. So let me jot that down. Calhoun, this is going to be like the greatest show notes page in the history of mankind right here. Not just in the history of this podcast, history of mankind, tomwoods.com/479. Now, getting to a little bit of Calhoun's work, one of the important insights that he had was that it's not enough to just engage in happy talk about democracy. He says, what really is going on here is that some groups are using their electoral strength to oppress other groups, that really you have some people who are ruling and other people who are ruled. That's the real story of what's happening. This is not a matter of our wise public servants are passing a law whose purpose is to bring about the general welfare. Like that, that is not what's going on. And what we need to do then is to try to prevent this, is to give the different minorities some way of defending themselves. You could say, we don't need to do this. All we need to do is to devise a constitution that will limit the powers of the government, and therefore you won't have this problem. But Calhoun pointed out that there's no really easy way to keep governments tethered to that document, to keep them from just abandoning it. What would stop them? Obviously, nothing can stop them. Oh, a vigilant public. Well, yeah, where are we going to get that? So he writes this. This is Calhoun himself. A written constitution certainly has many and considerable advantages, but it is a great mistake to suppose that the mere insertion of provisions to restrict and limit the power of the government, without investing those for whose protection they are inserted with the means of enforcing their observance, will be sufficient to prevent the major and dominant party from abusing its powers. Being the party in possession of the government, they will, from the same constitution of man which makes government necessary to protect society, be in favor of the powers granted by the Constitution and opposed to the restrictions intended to limit them. The minor or weaker party, on the contrary, would take the opposite direction and regard them, meaning the restrictions, as essential to their protection against the dominant party. But where there are no means by which they could compel the major party to observe the restrictions, the only resort left them would be a strict construction of the Constitution. To this, the major party would oppose a liberal construction. It would be construction against construction, the one to contract and the other to enlarge the powers of the government to the utmost. But of what possible avail could the strict construction of the minor party be against the liberal construction of the major, when the one would have all the power of the government to carry its construction into effect, and the other be deprived of all means of enforcing its construction? In a contest so unequal, the result would not be doubtful. The party in favor of the restrictions would be overpowered. The end of the contest would be the subversion of the Constitution. The restrictions would ultimately be annulled and the government be converted into one of unlimited powers. So, of course, the solution that Calhoun devised was this idea of the concurrent majority. So if you have some substantial interest, that ought to be able to defend itself. So you've got a state government, let's say, in the case of the United States, and it believes that the federal government is exceeding its powers and oppressing that minority, then this minority would have some kind of veto provision. It could veto this exercise of federal power as unconstitutional. And this is where Calhoun then gets into the discussion of state nullification, an idea that was quite older than just the 1830s when Calhoun was doing a lot of his writing. Let me share with you what Murray Rothbard had to say about all this analysis. So Rothbard was very much a fan of Calhoun, at least certain ideas of Calhoun that recur throughout Rothbard's writings. But he says this, while limitations would undoubtedly be more effective than at present, there are many difficulties and problems in the Calhoun solution. If indeed a subordinate interest should rightfully have a veto over matters concerning it, then why stop with the states? Why not place veto power in counties, cities, wards? Furthermore, interests are not only sectional, they are also occupational, social, etc. What of bakers or taxi drivers or any other occupation? Should they not be permitted a veto power over their own lives? This brings us to the important point that the nullification theory confines its checks to agencies of government itself. Let us not forget that federal and state governments and their respective branches are still states, are still guided by their own state interests rather than by the interests of the private citizens. What is to prevent the Calhoun system from working in reverse, with states tyrannizing over their citizens and only vetoing the federal government when it tries to intervene to stop that state tyranny? Or for states to acquiesce in federal tyranny? What is to prevent federal and state governments from forming mutually profitable alliances for the joint exploitation of the citizenry? And even if the private occupational groupings were to be given some form of functional representation in government, what is to prevent them from using the state to gain subsidies and other special privileges for themselves, or from imposing compulsory cartels on their own members? And Rothbard continues, in short, Calhoun does not push his path-breaking theory on concurrence far enough. He does not push it down to the individual himself. If the individual, after all, is the one whose rights are to be protected, then a consistent theory of concurrence would imply veto power by every individual, that is, some form of unanimity principle. When Calhoun wrote that it should be impossible to put or keep it, the government, in action without the concurrent consent of all, he was perhaps unwittingly implying just such a conclusion. But such speculation begins to take us away from our subject, for down this path lie political systems which could hardly be called states at all. For one thing, just as the right of nullification for a state logically implies its right of secession, so a right of individual nullification would imply the right of any individual to secede from the state under which he lives. Now, I agree with Rothbard's criticism here. I do address some of his arguments in my book, Nullification. I think you could have some replies to this, but what I've always said on nullification is that the only criticisms I will tolerate are criticisms that say it doesn't go far enough, it's too weak, it's too timid. I absolutely agree with that. I do think that there are likelihoods involved. I do think that it is likely that the states will tend to act so as to prevent federal encroachment more than they will tend to act to prevent federal attempts at liberating their citizens from state oppression. That's not an absolute guarantee by any means, but I think there are reasons to expect that. But that's neither here nor there. This is an interesting Rothbardian analysis of the Calhoun analysis. Now, let me just share with you some statements by Calhoun from all different circumstances. These are actually passages drawn from the McClanahan and Wilson book, Forgotten Conservatives in American History. I will link to that on the show notes page as well. In fact, again, my brain is not as reliable as it used to be. So let's put McClanahan and Wilson book at tomwoods.com/479. Anyway, here's a passage from Calhoun. We robbed the people in levying taxes. It was plunder and nothing more. Every cent removed from the hands of government is so much added to the wealth of the people. Every dollar we can prevent from coming into the treasury, or every dollar thrown back into the hands of the people, will tend to strengthen the cause of liberty and unnerve the arm of power. In the Senate, he said the following things. We all knew that when a public building was commenced, that it was never finished under five times the original estimate. How different things are now, of course, right? Then he says, all administrations were nearly alike extravagant. It was impossible to force the minds of the public officers to the importance of attendance to the public money because we have too much of it. And then he said, I have no doubt from what I daily see that our whole system is rapidly becoming a mere money-making concern to those who have the control of it, and that every feeling of patriotism is rapidly sinking into a universal spirit of avarice. He wrote to a young friend, the federal government is no longer under the control of the people, but of a combination of active politicians who are banded together under the name of Democrats or Whigs, and whose exclusive object is to obtain the control of the honors and emoluments of the government. They have the control of the almost entire press of the country and constitute a vast majority of Congress and of all the functionaries of the federal government. With them, a regard for principle or this or that line of policy is a mere pretext. They are perfectly indifferent to either, and their whole effort is to make up on both sides such issues as they may think for the time to be the most popular, regardless of truth or consequences. And then with regard to the Mexican War, these are Wilson and McClanahan writing, Calhoun raised a lonely voice against the surge of patriotism that ensued. He refused to support the war resolution in the Senate. A border incident did not necessarily call for all-out war, he said. More importantly, a perilous precedent had been set. The president had, in effect, initiated a war without waiting for the people or Congress. If this precedent were allowed to stand, it would empower any future president to commit the country to war at will. And so it has been. And they continue, we can measure the quality of Calhoun's statesmanship and love of democratic government when we realize that the war was very popular, especially in the South, and when we compare him with most of the Whigs in Congress. Opposed to the war and the Polk administration, they nevertheless voted for the war resolution out of fear of being branded as unpatriotic, and then voted no on all legislation to supply the army. And then finally, Calhoun wrote to his daughter, our people have undergone a great change. Their inclination is for conquest and empire, regardless of their institutions and liberty. Or rather, they think they hold their liberty by a divine tenure, which no imprudence or folly on their part can defeat. We act as if good institutions and liberty belong to us of right, and that neither neglect nor folly can deprive us of their blessing. You'll notice a lot of these statements by Calhoun sound eerily familiar because we live in the same world he did. All right, two things I want to leave you with. The first one is Brian McClanahan, the co-author of what I've spent some of this time today reading to you, is one of the faculty members at my Liberty Classroom, where you can learn the history and economics they didn't teach you. This is entirely separate from the Ron Paul curriculum, of course. I had Liberty Classroom long before there was a Ron Paul curriculum. Liberty Classroom has been used by many homeschoolers, but it's primarily, I think of it as an adult enrichment site for people who feel like they didn't get the real education they should have gotten, or who want to win debates, but they hold their tongue because they're afraid that maybe they just don't know enough to win a debate, this is the site for you. We're just about to add our 14th course without the price going up. As I say, it actually is going to go up before the end of the year, so I would grab it while you still can. Do check out Liberty Classroom at libertyclassroom.com. I've got a great faculty there. We've got 14 courses. We've got discussion forums. You can get all your questions answered. We have a live session once a month where we take your questions in real time. It's a whole lot of fun. Course number 14 with Brad Berzer is about to be added. Bob Murphy is going to be adding some economics courses. You're crazy not to be a member of this. You're absolutely crazy. It is the biggest bargain in the history of mankind. So check it out at libertyclassroom.com. I still have available a discount coupon code for you good listeners. The coupon code is SHOW in all caps, and that will get you a discount. The other thing is I got four events coming up in 2015 as of this moment. September 11th and 12th is Houston Liberty Fest. Then September 16th, I'm speaking as part of a Constitution Week event in Granby, Colorado. Then October 3rd is the Mises Circle in Dallas on political correctness. That's going to be fun. Tom DiLorenzo will be there. I'll be there. Lou Rockwell will be there. Probably Jeff Dice. I don't know anybody else, but certainly that's going to be great fun. Then in December, I am pretty sure it's December 4th, I am debating Michael Malice on the legacy of Alexander Hamilton in New York City. That's going to be tremendous. So check those all out for all the logistical details over at tomwoods.com/events. Remember the packed show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/479. And remember, I'll help you get that website or blog started up with some publicity, plus my guide for how to do it, my video tutorial, all that stuff over at tomwoods.com/publicity. You know you've been meaning to do it. Now I've made it easy for you. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.